This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Fake the Nation, episode 249.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we breathe a sigh of relief because, do I dare say it, justice was served. I am your host, Nikki Farsad, and I was walking on the streets of Manhattan running errands when I first heard the cheers for 420 at 420. And I was like, oh, that's the thing, marijuana, okay. And then, just like 30 minutes later or something, I heard the cheers on the street for the Chauvin verdict, because in New York, you don't need Twitter when you have the streets. Today, we're going to talk about that historic verdict. We'll also talk about some international news. And finally, that one bachelor came out as gay and as the star of a new TV show at the same time. What's it all mean? Today's panel. Folks, this is such an exciting panel. For the very first time, we're joined by the host of the podcast, Celebrity Book Club with Stephen and Lily. He's so funny. He's so delightful. And I've actually had the pleasure of working with him before, back when web series were a thing. And I loved him then, and I love him now. It's Stephen Phillips Horse. Hey, Stephen.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited to have you here. And our other panelist is a veteran of Fake the Nation. You know her. You love her. She's written a fantastic book that sits on my shelf that I also read. It didn't just sit on my shelf. She's a media trainer. She's a gadfly. She's an occasional talking head on the televisions. You've read her works all over. You've followed her hilarious, insightful tweets. She's twice vaccinated. Sally Cohn. Hey, Sally.
Hi, friend. I'm sorry to not be able to hug you. There aren't that many people I really actually would like to see at this point. But I would like to see you in person. And I suspect, Stephen, you'd be fun to see in person, too.
Yeah. Hey, no need to give me the sympathy position on the list, but I appreciate it.
Oh, you don't know me well enough to know I'm not that nice.
She really isn't. No. She really isn't. All right. Well, let's get into it with topic number one. We finally got the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial. Today we're recording on Wednesday. Chauvin was found guilty of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter, basically guilty on all three counts in the death of George Floyd. This is a rare, rare verdict in police brutality cases, and I am overcome. I just want to hear from you guys, like, just initially, how do you feel, Sally?
Yeah, that... you know, the feeling, right? You get the news alert and then you're staring, I don't know about everybody else, but I'm a New Yorker. I was staring at the New York Times page, reload, 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 wait. You know, they were showing the sort of blank courtroom for what seemed like an hour, waiting for someone to come on. And then, you know, the judge was speaking, and that catch in my chest, which, you know, as a white person, I can only imagine the extraordinary magnitude of the greatness of the feeling of that sort of fear at the inevitability of injustice that Black Americans carry daily. I had this microcosmic experience of it waiting for the verdict, fearing that, you know, what would happen again was what always happens, right? I mean, just we have to recognize how incredibly rare it is that he even was tried. Cops are never convicted. So, and that the surprise, the shock, the relief that actually the right thing happened here, really for me just should put in relief how rare it is that that happens. And, you know, I think I sort of stand with all the people saying, like, this is a step toward justice. This isn't justice. Justice would be a system and a world in which George Floyd was still living, and Derek Chauvin hadn't done what he did, didn't have the power to do what he did. But boy, was it a real shock to the system in every sense. I don't know that it necessarily indicates in any way, shape, or form the system has changed.
Stephen, how do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, relief, sure. I think relief was a huge feeling just immediately. For all the reasons you were just saying, Sally, I mean, it's so rare that we see a conviction in a case like that. We see any accountability for police, for cops who, you know, basically act with impunity. You know, I find it a little hard to get excited about what happens to one individual, you know, as you say, in a system, especially in the context of, you know, this Derek Chauvin represents a police force. He represents a state that is militarized against its own people. And to have the state come and say, well, this guy is bad. It kind of feels like it's like by saying that in this one case, this one thing that was bad, there's this implication, but everything else is basically the state sort of functioning how it should. And so it makes you think, you know, the situation is so extraordinary, especially with the attention on it, right? I mean, so basically, you know, if you're caught, okay, well, if this person you kill becomes the most famous murder of the year, of the most talked about, you know, sparks international protests, there couldn't be more attention on this, then maybe there'll be some accountability. But if not, then, you know, you're probably fine. I mean, that feels like, yeah, it's quite hard to get excited about that. And you know, and I also, being just the circumstance surrounding death, you know, it's like, okay, so, you know, because this death was him standing with his knee on George Floyd's neck, the particular circumstance of the death, I thought, made it easier for the prosecution to make the argument that he was not doing what he was supposed to be doing as a policeman. But, you know, if it had been a shooting, of which there are so many all the time, I think it's a lot easier for them to say, well, I shot because I was scared. You know, it's easier for them to let the police go in those situations. So it just feels like, you know, all the situation was so specific and there were so many factors, such as the swirling storm of factors that made, you know, got us to the place where we could, like, maybe finally have some accountability in one of these scenarios. And it feels like it'd be so rare that all those things would combine like that again. And it doesn't feel like that's a model that can be applied for the future.
Okay, I'm a little bit more optimistic than that. Also because this morning, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced that the Justice Department is going to launch an investigation into possible patterns of discrimination and excessive force in the Minneapolis Police Department. And I found that also heartening because where you're saying this is about Derek Chauvin, the individual, and what kind of punishment is meted out to him, Merrick Garland is saying, let's also pick up the slack on the systemic problems with that particular police force and see what's going on there. And are they just, to me, like, I don't know if police departments follow the Geneva Convention, but I'm a little bit like, should we just a quick reminder of the Geneva Convention for everybody would be there should be an general federal oversight. And what are these people being taught to do as police officers? What are the, like, basic values in every police department that are being engendered? You know, all of that stuff. Like, I think this does feel like a step in that direction that'll make something like the Derek Chauvin case not just like a one-off, but like a more, give us a more systemic approach to what's happening in police departments writ large. And my first thought was just like, knowing what we do know now about the ability of the American public to galvanize marchers and actions and petitions and just like the entire like spirit of the nation in a bipartisan way, by the way, the numbers who were mortified by the killing of George Floyd were bipartisan, overwhelming numbers. I can't remember what it was. It was like 80% of Americans thought it was horrendous. And so I think knowing now that that's where we are, that murder like that is not right, my first thought was maybe police officers will think twice before using excessive force. And I just did have that little moment, little moment of hope on top of the Merrick Garland thing. Like, I don't want to like take this thing that is a victory and just shit on it.
You know? No, no, and I think that's what we do. So, like, that's what we do as the left.
I do have a hopeful, hopeful look in, about it.
I think we do that as a left. So you're right. It's useful to, you know, we're both so accustomed to losing and so accustomed to this sort of Sisyphean task of pushing justice up the hill that there are moments, you know, when you win, even if you want to put those moments in context and so forth, that you do want to actually take a moment. I mean, right. It's just, even to call this a win is complicated, right? Because again,
sure,
someone is dead. You know, right. And also to put this in context,
many families' lives have been just ruined.
And also
grief is enormous. It's, you know,
and also that case, right. It was sort of like what we're seeing with the situation with the shooting in Chicago and others where, you know, the outrage and the outcry and including this sort of sense of bipartisan outcry happens after we see a video. And so the problem is this notion of like, there's so much on top of this, and to Stephen's point, it has to have all these conditions, et cetera, rather than to be a presumption of a problem. And that's where we get to the core of this, I think, Nagin, which is, look, I mean, there've been federal consent decrees over police departments before, et cetera. A lot of that is premised, and I mean, this is no slight to Merrick Garland or anything, you know, folks who believe this, well, I guess, I mean, it is a somewhat slight, you know, sort of premised on a bad apple theory, right? Like, well, you've got your Derek Chauvins and these other cops and they're bad apples and we've got to figure out what is, you know, causing the bad apples, but, you know, some prune the tree and we'll be fine. And then there's another theory, and this is really what we're fighting about right now as a country, which says, look, fundamentally, the tree is poisoned from the roots, right? You have policing. Let's just like look at two data points. You have a system of policing in this country that is the direct legacy of slave patrols, right? Policing as an institution was started to keep Black people, Black lives, Black bodies in, quote unquote, in their place. But that is the whole reason we had policing in this country to begin with. Now, fast forward, recent leaked data showed that when Kyle Rittenhouse, the young white guy who went and shot at a bunch of Black Lives Matter protesters, a vigilante, armed vigilante, the kind of person you would think cops would be against, going and shooting at Black Lives Matter protesters, there were not just one, not just two, but a number of current active police and military who donated to his defense. Now, it is hard to draw a line between those two points, not to mention everything that's happened in between. Right? And say that there isn't a problem here. There's a problem with policing. There's a problem with the sort of militarization and absolute power of life and death and judgment that we put on policing, mapped on top of our societal, corrosive white supremacist ideas of who is good, who is bad, who needs protecting, and who needs protecting from. On top of which is the very fact that we have police respond to things they shouldn't friggin' be responding to in the first place. Mental health challenges, poverty, unhappy, right? Like we have over-relied on a system that at its best is pretty systemically rotten. So I don't know that just like scrutinizing one department is gonna solve that.
No, I totally, I, all of your points are like completely right. And I think, again, because I don't want to view it as a Sisyphean task, because in that metaphor, it means we really never win. And that's not the case, right? Like, eventually we do. And that's how I want to live my life, that like, eventually we do reach a point where we do have some sort of police system that we're happy with. We do have no cases of police brutality, right? Like that's the world I want to live in, where I believe that change is possible. And so I think the other thing about it is there's some of the, I mentioned this, I think last week or the week before, a lot of this stuff is just it's a management problem. We're allocating the wrong resources to the things that come up, and we gotta fix it. It's like none of these things are rocket science. It's just about how we implement changes, you know? And like, for example, right now in Ithaca, they actually are making huge changes to the police department, and we'll see. The other crazy thing is the police department is run like, you know, it's like several thousand little fiefdoms. So that's the other crazy part of it is, like, you know, it's hard to get one standard going just because of the way that our country is set up. So but again, like, this case in Ithaca, it's worth looking at what will happen because that's a way, you know, there's actual will in Ithaca to change something. You know, there was help from the city council to get that passed, and now they're going to implement some kind of a major change in how in fundamentally how they police that small town. And so that'll be, you know, look, that's interesting. And there's going to be cases like that around the country. What I did want to talk about, though, before we leave the subject, is a little bit how the conservative media covered the verdict. So, for example, Newsmax and Fox News, they offered scant coverage on Sharpton's prayer. There's a prayer before moving on to discussions that featured white pundits and legal scholars critical of the proceedings, which I guess is highly unsurprising. Tucker Carlson, everybody's favorite. Remember when Tucker Carlson was just like a guy who wore bow ties and like didn't really matter that much in the cultural conversation?
He found his way in, didn't he? He found his way in.
Those were like bionic bow ties that had powers that I didn't know. I didn't know his bow ties had these powers. It's we should have stopped the bow ties before they became self-aware.
Don't get me started.
He said that the jury was intimidated and pressured by Black Lives Matter protesters that he called riots. And warned that people, because of verdicts like this, will leave the country, saying it's a quote, an attack on civilization. He loves stuff that's like an attack on civilization. He loves that kind of phrasing. An attack on civilization. Which I was like, don't you want immigrants to leave the country? Like, will you take, like, wouldn't you be happy if just some people left the country and then we just have, like, even out the numbers for you or whatever anyways? But here's my question for you. A lot of it, like, conservatives, Stephen, are saying that, like, the police won't do their job. Like, they take Carlson's view that the police aren't going to do their job because of instances like this. What do you think this is having on, like, on police that are legitimately called to help in a criminal situation?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if a cop is deterred from firing their weapon on someone when they shouldn't, or killing someone, or using force, or anything like that, like, that is a good thing, obviously. You know, but I think it comes to the question of what is policing, like, what happens when a community is policed? And I think that so often the policing just comes with violence. And there's kind of like, you know, I'm interested and intrigued by these situations, and maybe, you know, what you were referencing, Ithaca, if there's a possibility that policing can change a little bit, but, you know, it seems like it always comes with violence. You know, I will say Black Lives Matter movement protests, like, years ago, not just last year, but I remember, like, feeling like the NYPD in the city that we are based in, if we can reveal that on this pod. That, you know, I felt, I was like, they almost seem a little bit less, like, they're a little bit more afraid of us. They almost seem like there is a temporary feeling, like, and it may have been completely a projection, right? But that they were a little less aggressive. You know, I've had so many encounters with the police in my time living in New York, all of them negative. You know, I've been arrested many times, and it's always for, you know, I don't think I'm a menace to society. Everything I've ever been arrested for was silly. It was either, you know, jumping the turnstile or...
I mean, that Hawaiian t-shirt, though, tells a story.
Right, no. You know, it tells a story. It says, do you work at Trader Joe's? And is that a problem? So it's like, I've never had a positive experience. And, you know, and I've been beaten up. I've been mugged. I've been gay bashed. I've been held up at gunpoint. I've had so many violent things happen to me in New York. And the police never stopped any of those things. The police were never there when I, you know, they weren't. The whatever policing is didn't stop those things from happening. And when I went to the police after those things happened, they were not any help to me. So, you know, I'm my story is not unique. There are so many people who have stories like this, encounters with the police that are just like, you know, entirely negative. So I'd like to think that maybe they get a little bit gun shy. Maybe they get a little bit cowed by this kind of thing. Maybe they, like, you know, lean back for a minute, for a week. But I feel like overall, they walk around as bullies and they're not going to stop being bullies. I mean, I think also, you know, something that's interesting about this conservative reaction to this is, you know, conservatives, they're upset that we're talking about Black lives mattering. They're upset that we're talking about Black people being killed by police. They never get upset about all the white people who are killed by police, which I think is very telling, because they don't actually care about people getting killed by police, because they think that the role of police is good and they like the bullying that they do.
I'm really sorry to hear about all of your experiences with the police. It sounds horrible. But Sally, final thoughts on this.
First of all, there's a problem in our kind of cultural imagination about policing, right? Which is, we have these sort of two narratives from our film and our TV, and right, of like, on the one hand, you've got the like small town, you know, goofy, nicely neighbor cop.
We have a mayor of East Town.
Right.
Like on HBO, where she's like handling everything and her ethics are can't be questioned.
And then we have like the Law and Order police procedurals, where every single day the cops' lives are at jeopardy and they're breaking down the doors. And and the reality is, what's interesting is that this sort of very, let's call it like what it is, this very black and white, right, notion of policing, right, also maps onto our implicit and explicit understanding of what policing does, right? And the sense that, well, for someone like me, a white woman, to be safe, and let's be clear, so much of, again, going back to, you know, times of indentured slavery, so much of our policing of Black bodies is about, quote unquote, protecting white women, so, and white property. So, you know, our notion that for that to exist, for my safety and the safety of my property and whatever to exist, there has to be the other, right? And that's just not true, right? I mean, what actually keeps us safe is good government, is community, is education, is, right? I mean, we know all these things. And the reality is, so here's an interesting point that I always think about in these conversations, is that about 80% of Americans, according to surveys, believe that the average cop fires their gun at least once in the course of their career. The reality is that 98% of cops don't ever fire their gun. Right? So it's not only, it's like, there's this, and again, part of the mythology that in part the right creates because they believe in guns keeping us safe and so forth, is that, well, but these cops are using their guns so many times when they have to and need to, and it's not true, right?
Yeah, and I so also want to go back to, like, I've talked about this a million times, but, like, in the UK, they don't police with guns, you know what I mean? And look, there's tons of problems in the UK, whatever, that are different, but I think the idea that you can have successful policing without guns, that's out there.
Like, you pull your gun out instead of your taser. Like, good Lord, you have a taser. What do you need the gun for, right?
You don't need the gun.
And then again, but again, that maps onto how many times we have all seen cops de-escalate situations without violence when the alleged perpetrator is a white person. I mean, it's just, it's, so it gets to, and it's on some level, it is the problem of police. On some level, it's not, right? You just happen to have they are the knife's edge of broader patterns and histories and problems in our society, but they just happen to be the deadly knife's edge.
Right. Well, we can talk about this forever. Folks, tell me what you think, and let me know what you think. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. But you know what we're going to do? We're going to take a quick break and we are going to learn about our sponsors. I'm so excited about our sponsors today because they keep the lights on here at Fake the Nation. So we really love them. And then when we come back, we'll talk about other things. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money. And because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry. Thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you. So you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8-exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. And we are back and we're ready for topic number two. The Bachelor has long been the bastion of heterosexual reality TV show lust, and all of that was shaken when former Bachelor Colton Underwood came out of the closet on Good Morning America. But also, a few hours after he came out, literally just a few hours, there was another announcement that Underwood would star in a new TV show on Netflix about coming out, alongside a sort of gay guide Olympian Gus Kentworthy. I guess it's sort of like a Queer Eye for the queer guy. It was huge news. The trended for like 3 days. My first question is, why was this such big news?
I'm really hoping this is Stevens, because we're making true confessions here after the
yes.
First of all, by the way, smooth segue, super smooth. And second of all, are you ready for this? I feel like McGee and this could ruin our friendship. I've never watched The Bachelor.
Wow.
Not ever once.
My jaw just hit the floor.
Have you watched?
Oh, honey. I
get the premise.
I've only just passingly seen something. It's not like I can't even recount how episodes are structured or anything. So you may be our resident expert, Stephen. Why was this such big news?
You know, I'm fine with taking that mantle of Bachelor expert. Okay. And I will say it's the kind of show where, you know, the show is better than the premise, right? The premise is pretty simple. We get it. Like, one person is dating a bunch of people and they fall in love with one. But the actual machinations of the show and the way that they edit together these absolutely absurd, you know, rivalries and bitter dramas and fights and romances and tears. And you know, it's very well done. And there's just so much of it. And obviously, you know, it's sort of a self-selecting thing in reality shows at this point. But the cast members tend to be quite stupid. And so that creates a lot of joy for the viewers, I would say. So the Bachelor, as you say, it is a bastion of heterosexuality. It is, but in many ways, it's obviously, you know, it's an absurd, kind of send up of heterosexuality, right? Because the concept is for the Bachelor. So this is when there's one guy and there's 25 women and this is, and it's
25.
Yeah. And
that's a lot.
No, it's
and how many weeks do they have to choose between 25?
I want to say it's about 10 weeks or so. And so
they're cutting a lot of ladies.
There's quite a lot of culling the first few weeks. Then they would stop when there's still six people left in the competition. You know what I mean? You wouldn't get a winner. You'd get six winners. So the idea that this is like, you know, so shocking, is this is like a perversion of this, like, you know, this temple to heterosexuality is a little bit ridiculous, because the show is completely ridiculous. And the show assumes that over the course of 10 weeks, by simultaneously dating 25 people, you will find the love of your life. I mean, to some extent, I think there's some sort of interesting potential science there, because in the idea that, well, out of 25 people, potentially one of them you could fall in love with. I think that, like,
it strikes me as very lesbian. Like, we can fall in love,
right? Exactly.
We can do it in 3 weeks. Just saying. Yeah.
If you want a more efficient show, the Bachelor franchise should go lesbian. That makes
it's
a lot
just
of sense.
It's literally just a 2 week show, and
sponsored by U-Haul.
By week two, they're just assembling IKEA furniture.
They're assembling IKEA furniture. Half of all the contestants are already dating each other, or they're already each other's exes, but they're still friends. It's very.
You know,
it ends with like a spirited Friendsgiving.
This is going to end up a thing. But anywho, go ahead.
I mean, we just, by the way, TM, the three of us, and let us get the money.
Well, you know, there was a gay Bachelor many years ago on Logo, and it was called, like, He's the Guy or something. It had some very unimaginative name. And I felt like the kind of unspoken issue was that it was a bunch of bottoms competing for a top. But, like, they didn't really ever kind of, like, surface that tension.
Right,
But it was, like clearly, like, I think that's, like, basically what's happening here. Because it was a lot of the same dynamics where it was, you know, all the bottoms were, like, waiting to get their rose. And then there's this, like, you know, this hunky top that they're all competing for. And, of course,
you better dethorn that rose.
Yeah.
This is horrendous. We're all fired.
That could be messy.
First of all, thank you so much for this, like, just primer on just the Bachelor as a phenomenon, like, seeping into the logo channel's attempt to even do it. But what did you watch the Colton Underwood season, and what do you think of that dude?
Yeah, so a lot of the Bachelors seem kind of gay, I will say, because the vibe of the show is gay. Like, you've got a guy, they're always in really tight jeans. You know, they're wearing a ton of makeup. Like, they're on TV. They're doing this performative thing where they, like, the women get in evening gowns. And then they all meet up at a hotel lobby. And they, like, have cocktails. And there's something very gay about that. And, like, and also, the whole, you know, allegedly, they, like, don't have sex for 2 months. So, that's also very gay, you know? Like, you're like, oh, no, I don't want to fuck these women for 2 straight months. It's just like, huh, okay.
Are the women allowed to sleep with each other?
I imagine. I mean, they tend to be the straightest women you've ever met in your life.
Has that been a thing?
I don't think they've even ever put, like, a bi contestant on, which you would think they would do just, like, for ratings, but... Yeah, for some reason, that has not happened in the Women of the Bachelor.
Sorry, I'm just going to call the booking representative for The Bachelor. Just put you on hold.
Wait, okay, but like, when he came out, okay, so about Colton.
He has kind of this, like, Joey, kind of simple, he had this very, very innocent vibe to him, where he was, like, really nervous, and he really liked the just, like, I mean, they're all, like, you know, pretty vapid, but, like, he really liked this very kind of, like, Barbie doll-looking girl that was very, like, the kind of girl that, like, I think that I would have said I liked when I was 10. Like, that kind of, like, stage of sexual maturity.
Right, because she fit the description.
Of, like, woman that, like, you know, you were told as child. And they had this very chaste relationship, as they do in The Bachelor. They say lots of completely inane things. They go on these, very expensive dates where they ride helicopters and, like, get massages and, like, go to Thailand. And they say things just
like... How much straight up, like, boning is there in The Bachelor?
Well, allegedly, you do not bone until you get to the fantasy suites, which is, like, the second to last week. And the host... It's so twisted.
The host of The Bachelor... It's, like, scheduled?
It's scheduled.
Scheduled sex?
When it gets down to 3 people.
Now this show does seem lesbian.
Yeah. Okay, but the creepy part is once you get down, you have these dates, and then the host of the show grants you this very, like, ornate medieval key that unlocks your fantasy suite, and you can decide whether to go ahead and use the fantasy suite at the end of the date.
And Colton, did he sleep with the lady? Like, I mean, I don't mean to be gross here, but like...
Well, as you can imagine, this is on ABC. So when they go to the fantasy suite, the camera kind of pans away. You see the curtains or whatever. But
you're not
necessarily seeing penetration on network television. So it's hard to say. And then they'll do this thing where they shoot the next morning and, like, they're always both in bed in, like, cashmere sweatpants. And, like, she's on his chest just being like, that was the most amazing night of my life. So, yeah, you kind of assume they fucked, but it's, you don't know.
Oh, this is ridiculous.
But wait, he ended up with someone.
He like, did, but
then,
like,
well, a whole controversy.
Well,
did they get married or whatever, however they do the marrying?
Here's the thing about The Bachelor. Everyone breaks up. Every single couple breaks up within, like, 5 months of the show ending. Like, without question. Like, I think it's, like, I think the percentage rate is just, like, 98.5% of Bachelor couples break up within the first 5 months. And it's just, like, 100% of the Bachelorettes, like, break up. And then maybe, and then it's, like, 95% of the Bachelors, like, break up. Because, you know, they switch genders every season.
Right.
And typically The Bachelor is just more fun because women are more fun, and so they're just much more fun characters to watch. Because all the Bachelorette season is like 25 guys, and they're all just like sitting in salmon shorts, being just like, "Whoa, dude, I think I like her," and you're like, "Okay."
Yeah, could you put any more additional analysis on that feeling? No, okay. Stephen, what can you tell me? Your reaction to the coming out?
Well, I mean, you know, as I said, it's a very performative show. It's this sort of, like, obscene, like, you know, grotesque, send-up of what, you know, heterosexual union can be, which is, of course, already a grotesque and obscene thing, no offense to any of those of you who may be in a heterosexual union at this current point in time. But
he's talking about me.
But, like, you know, so I was like...
I think he knows he's not talking about me. But go on, Stephen. Go on.
But family. No, but I was... I guess, you know, listen. Is there a certain delight that we all get when we find out there's another one on the team? Sure. You know, there's a...
You took out your ledger and added one. And you got really excited.
And, of course, you know, statistically... There's been 20-something seasons of The Bachelor. One of them has to be gay. Statistically, that is just simply a fact. So, that makes sense. Okay.
So you were you like, I mean, there were, because there was backlash about this because it was because then a few hours later it came out that he was going to be in the lead in this Netflix show, new Netflix reality show. And so it just, the backlash was essentially that he's kind of like commodifying his new LGBTQ status.
Honey, aren't we all?
Did you?
I mean, yeah, everyone. I mean, the idea that someone who competed on a reality show is now commodifying their identity and that is somehow different than what they were doing before, I think is a little ridiculous. Every single person who goes on a reality show.
That's exactly it, because he was commodifying his
love,
his supposed love.
And now he's...
Right. You're not going there to find love.
You're going there to be on TV and then break up with the person that picks you at the end of
it. Well,
Wait, you guys, I did some Googling and there have been like two lesbian couples resulting from the
Former contestants who are now dating?
Well, listen, I don't do the Bachelor speak, but Demi and Christian hooked up on Bachelor in Paradise, apparently. Demi having been in the Colton Underwood episodes.
Okay, well, Bachelor in Paradise is sort of this like buy for
but
shock value show,
but there was another one too. Anyway, yeah, there have been like two.
Are they still together?
At least one of them have broken up. Shocker. But yeah, I would think if I were hanging around with 24 other women, in evening gowns, well, the evening gown part would be weird, but other than that, I'm just saying, I'd find love.
It feels inevitable. It feels inevitable. The
2021.
Just the reaction to, like, you know, the people being shocked that he's commodifying his sexuality, I agree, is a little bit ridiculous in that he was already commodifying his sexuality. Why would he be a different why would it be like fundamentally different and not commodify, you know, his actual sexuality, right? Like it doesn't make sense. And the other thing is, like, sometimes when people speak publicly about being gay or Muslim or feminist or, you know, ethnic of some kind or whatever other category you want, we sort of then expect that person to be angelic, you know what I mean? Mm. And that they are somehow like have a higher standard about absolutely everything under the sun. And it's like, it's okay for this guy to have come out and then to be a dirty, dirty capitalist. You know what I mean? Like, that's like, it's like, to me, I'm like, he's not an angel because, like, he came out of the closet. We shouldn't expect him to then suddenly have some otherworldly ethical qualities. Like, he's gay. Like, he's not magic. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Gay people
like,
are statistically more
thing.
Likely to be angelic and magic. However, your point is taken.
Yeah. No.
I do say I would love him to have a different coach in his gayness that might, you know, work on the sort of ethical justice, public gay qualities of, you know, history and but you know,
I don't know this coach. Are you familiar with the Gus Cantworthy School of Gay guidance?
So there is a gay citizenship test, and most of us take it in our early 20s. We study for years. There are many, many ancient scrolls that we pore over, over many long nights. And then we are given a certificate. And it's a proud moment. And I, you know, I still have my photo up on my wall. It's not, you can't see it here, but it's behind that curtain.
So
closing thoughts, Stephen, I mean, I guess The Bachelor is such a huge series and it has such a life, not only on network television where it reaches millions, but then on social media where it reaches millions and millions and millions more. Is there something in here that's maybe like good? You know what I
good.
Mean?
But like, what is good?
Like,
define just, good.
Just that, like,
that was one of those gay citizenship tests.
Just that, like, you maybe liked this character, and hey, he's gay, and you can still like him. I don't know. Like, is there something
I would say
mainstream America that loves The Bachelor that might, I don't know where this might be.
No. I just think that I don't think The Bachelor really sets trends in terms of like, social cultural acceptance and politics. I think they tend to lag trends. I think that they're a very like sort of old war horse, and so it's just like if The Bachelor is having a gay contestant, that means that like people are really okay with gay people at this point. Like that it's just like not that big of a deal. It's like, you know, I think like it is. It's been pretty normalized. At this point that some former Bachelor contestant from a few seasons ago is gay, it is just like, it's not that big of a deal. Like, I think that just, all that really, I mean, I guess that's nice that it's so normal, that we're just so fucking normal, but...
Yeah. Steven is
Steven,
so
you're so
it.
Normal. Yeah. You're,
I mean, look,
so normal.
There's a lovely, you know, it is a lovely moment, right? At any time, a little more visibility, a little more inclusion, you know, a little more space is opened up for others, right? A kid somewhere who didn't know anyone who's gay, either they're gay themselves or they, you know, were feeling homophobic and now they have one person who they kind of had some fondness for.
Right.
And I mean, right. I think that's all positive. I don't think we can ever overstate, you know, we don't want to understate the sort of power of cultural transformation of these moments, right? And at the same time, you don't want to mistake a moment for systemic transformation, you know, policy change, is that right? I mean, they relate to each other, right? But
yeah.
One isn't a stand-in for the other. But I say, hey, gay people creating tacky shows is just as great. I want gay people to create garbage content too. And it sounds to me like the show's gonna be garbage content. And I won't watch it, but Steven, if you could watch it and then tell me all about it.
I will report back. I will do the hard work.
All right, folks. What do you think of the Bachelor and this news? And I don't know. Let me know what you think. Do you watch it? I feel like Sally, I feel like me and you learned a lot in this segment. Oh. So that
you were
going
to invite me over to like binge The Bachelor, and
you know,
I was like, yeah,
Steven, you were our Bachelor guide for this segment. So I appreciate that. And before we move on to topic number three, I just want to say, Patreon listeners, your bonus segment for this week is up. It is hilarious. It is with Bassem Youssef and Benari Poulton, and we talk about bagels, and it gets real heated. So you should have that episode in your Patreon inboxes, and if you want to join Patreon to get these fun bonus episodes, you can go to patreon.com/Nagin Farsad. Now let us move on to topic number three. Okay, so one of our wonderful Irish-American listeners, Mairead, reached out to ask if we would talk about the riots in Northern Ireland, and I jumped on it because this is big news, but I'm also confused by it. So let's talk about it. But listeners, please remember that whenever we talk about issues that are international in scope, I schwitz because I don't necessarily know what I'm talking about. But here, this is from what I understand, just a quick primer on what may have been the case. Back in the 80s and 90s, when things were really bad in Northern Ireland, the main issue was that a largely Catholic side that wanted to, the territory to be a part of Ireland. And there was a mostly Protestant side that wanted the territory to remain part of Britain. And what ended the Irish Troubles, as they're called, was a peace agreement 1998. But all of those scabs are being picked right now. Gross. I don't know why I said that. Scabs are being picked because of Brexit and the pandemic. Because there was that whole thing with like a hard border. You guys remember this talk that lasted for years about this hard border shit? Well, that is still a thing. There's a border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. And it makes it tough because Ireland's still a part of the European Union, but Northern Ireland, as a part of the UK, is now has Brexited. So, what do you think, guys? Like, so there's been.
I feel your anxiety. So
I know. I'm so sorry.
I'm not gonna lie, but I really feel like Stephen. I don't know much about you, but. Nagin, I feel like as the Jew in the air and you being the Muslim, like we should be comfortable talking about sectarian divisions.
I know we should be comfortable talking about sectarian divisions.
This ain't nothing new. This is the Irish version. otherwise, that's exactly the fucking same.
Exactly. So the sectarian divisions are also being, you know. Flamed. And the reason that there has been riots, and you've probably seen in your news that there have been riots in Belfast. It was about 10 days ago that they started. They last for about a week. I don't know what's going on today. And they started because the pandemic is making it so that some supplies aren't getting in to Northern Ireland.
Correct.
And Brexit is making it so that some supplies aren't getting in. And then there's another weird thing with the pandemic, which is that Sinn Féin, the unionist group in Northern Ireland, this is where I start.
You're doing great.
Am I
keep
saying
going.
All the right words?
You're doing
Thank
great.
You. Thank you so much. Sinn Féin like had a crowd of people gathered because in remembrance of someone, and they were not prosecuted because they basically violated pandemic protocol. With that gathering. So
yeah, it's more
there,
the,
so there
it's
a
more
lot
the
of,
Brexit
like,
stuff,
that,
right? It's more the Brexit stuff. And this was the, like, you know, when, like, Britain, after they voted, kept, like, failing to come up with an actual Brexit plan. This was the primary sticking point. And you know, what you basically have to understand is that the, you know, the period of the Troubles was brutal. And it was because of, you know... you know, it's complicated, right? Because it has something to do with sectarianism, right? Because it ends up mapping out religiously, but ultimately it's a somewhat nationalist kind of, it almost more easily maps onto kind of notions of colonialism and imperialism, right? Where you have a certain group of people in a territory who want to belong to one country and you have, and be a part of one country, right? The Catholics want Northern Ireland to be part of Ireland. And you have the Protestants who want Northern Ireland to be part of England. And what happened in the agreements, in the Good Friday Accords, was basically a kind of power sharing agreement that said, like, look, we're going to, you know, kind of give a little bit to everyone and try to make everyone happy. And part of that is going to be things like more easy flow across the borders of people and goods, allowing people to have dual citizenship, right? So it was a really powerful,
so that border
hard-fought
became,
hybrid.
That border became more of like a fun suggestion rather than something.
Well, and it was in keeping with, and in a lot of ways actually kind of, you know, it was part of the trend of what was happening with the EU more broadly, right? And then you have Brexit, which just is a wholly dumb fuck of an idea, right?
It's
across
so
the
bad.
Board. So bad. So
not
bad.
Into it.
Right? And
still
like,
not into
was,
it.
You know, and it is so... there's something so Trumpian in it, right? Because, and if you go back, if people haven't seen Carol Caldwaller's TED Talk and read her reporting about how Brexit was sold to the people who are going to be hurt in England by Brexit, their jobs are on the line, right? It was a dumb fuck of a policy that then they botched the implementation of, because really everybody was like, oh shit, it passed. We don't actually know how to do this because you have an integrated economy. And with Europe and in this relationship
Northern
between
Ireland thing,
right? And it's fucked, right? And they did not. They tried to come up with a good deal. They tried. They failed. And then there's some other, you know, things that sort of shit hit the fan kind of moments, including the large gathering. But it really goes to show that sort of policy actually matters, right? It matters to people's lives. That, and you really think, like, you look at the kind of leaders who, for all their imperfections, hammered out that Good Friday Accord, and now the, like, bungling idiots, right? Like Boris Johnson, who are just like, oh, let's just leave, and oh, we'll fight, you know, and it actually, like, leadership matters, good government matters, thoughtful government matters.
You know, sucks. The other thing that I think is, like, also happening in terms of, like, leadership matters is if Boris Johnson is a Trumpian version in the UK of a leader, and Stephen, I don't know if you feel this, that, like, globally we're this kind of sectarian, these kinds of sectarian tensions might rise just because they're, like, in the air, you know, through the leadership of Brexit. So it's sort of like there's no one at the top being like let's handle this, you know, in a way that makes management sense, that makes policy sense. You know what I mean? There isn't a bunch of rational people at the top. There's just like, yeah, we're doing a Brexit. We don't know how. Everybody is pissed. Like, and so then it's, you're more likely to just have a bunch of people pissed, you know, when they can't get, when there are shortages in Northern Ireland because of a now ridiculous border. Stephen, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. People being pissed begets people being pissed. I mean, that's an old saying. I think exactly, that's in the Talmudic verses or something like that. You know, you pressurize situation. You rattle a couple sabers over here. The sabers over there are going to rattle too. But I think, you know, what's interesting about the Brexit situation is obviously when it was sold, like, it was this very long process, right? So when it was sold and there was that vote and they had the, you know, leave remain, you know, there was, it was sold as, like, you know, in the very Trumpian way, it was anti-immigration. It was like, these Eastern Europeans are going to come take your jobs. These Mediterraneans are going to take your jobs. There was a lot of racism. There was a lot of nativism. There was a lot of nationalism, all this stuff. Then it, like, took them so long to do this whole thing. And the Conservatives won their, like, last election by saying, get Brexit done. That was their thing. That was our slogan. They were just like, this process has gone on for so long, you're all just exhausted hearing about it. And it no longer was even, like, you know, hewing to the same political/moral conservative arguments per se. It was just like, at this point, like, you're just fucking exhausted hearing about policy. You don't care about this shit. Government is boring. Like, government just, like, has its thumb up its own ass, and we all have our thumb up our, like, you know, our bewigged asses and all these barristers with their little curls. So just wrap it up already. Get Brexit done. And the simplicity of that, the, you know, the shortness of it was just like, that was appealing. They were like, oh, great, fuck this, you know? And so I think, like, now we're seeing, oh, there's this, like, there's all this bad, there's consequences. There's consequences to that. But, like, the whole reason we did this is because we didn't even want consequences or not. We just didn't want anything. We just, like, we're fucking sick of hearing about shit. And so it's kind of like, you know, you think about, well, how does it play to America? How does it play, you know, elsewhere on the world? And it's just like, people are actually, like, sick and tired. People are fucking sick and tired of bullshit. And it's kind of hard to say, let's have a long drawn out policy discussion, because the longer that discussion draws out, the less people want to have it. And the less they want to, like, deal with what the consequences were. They don't want anything. They just, like, and so then you just get status quo. So I feel like it's not a great situation, but, you know, I think we're gonna have to figure out a way to have those tough conversations, because we're kind of here because of a lap, because I feel like people just didn't even want to have these talks anymore.
Oh, complete. I mean, I didn't even want it to be in the news anymore. And I could easily just not read it, but I was just like, oh, can they figure out this Brexit thing? It's so annoying. And, like, you know, but in terms of consequences, I mean, we're closer than we've ever been to Scottish independence because of Brexit. We're closer than, you know, right now with these riots, it looks like that whole notion of Irish unification is just coming right back up to the fore. And so this one dumb act of Brexit could just lead to a total changing of the international map, you know, because they didn't think it through. And it was sold with, you know, like you said, Sally, to the people who it would affect. It was sold, you know, too simplistically and without an explanation of what it would really mean.
Can I just throw out a theory?
Make this a great theory because it's closing out the segment.
Pretty badass theory about sovereignty and self-determination is that see those words? Okay. So, you know, you're talking about Scotland, Northern Ireland, you know, we have Palestine, we have Barcelona and like Catalan, you know, there's all these places around the world. There's potential, you know, there's discussion of will these break away, will they become an independent nation, country, you know, and should, you know, and there's a whole question of like whether or not a place should have the right to like say whether it should be a country or separate from somewhere else. And then there's a whole EU question, should the EU be all basically one country or should it be, you know, all together and then we're breaking apart? We don't want this sort of supranational organizations. But I do wonder if all of the sort of agitation for independence and for smaller states is almost a dying gasp in an age when we are heading to a sort of global corporate hegemony in which corporations act unilaterally, corporations act worldwide, and that, you know, they do whatever they want in whatever country they feel like it. And their law is actually the sort of supreme law of the land. And we are more subject to the whims of Amazon and Facebook than we are to the whims of a government, and that governments themselves are becoming smaller and smaller in terms of the power that they wield over our lives.
You know what? I feel like you're just Steven setting us up for another segment, which is that I actually feel like you're not off base and that there's so much more legislation now targeting tech giants, maybe for that very reason. You know what I mean? Because countries are like, wait a second, we're the country things, the things that have the
right.
laws.
We're supposed to.
Yeah, except you guys for no, right? Like the paradox inherent in what Stephen's talking about is if we like divide this then in ideological terms, you know, the people who would say, hey, look, we should have more, let's say not no borders, but more porid, fluid, mm-hmm. realistic borders vis-a-vis people and ideas and so forth, are generally the sort of center left folks, right? Who are also the ones saying like, hey, we have to rein in, you know, the unlimited, unchecked power of global corporations, which are sort of obviating sovereignty and rights and so on and so forth. And you actually have the people on the other side who are like, no, we need sovereignty when it comes to people. And who are like, yeah, sure, when it comes to, you know, globalization, corporate dominance, corporate takeover, you know, violating any kind of remotely sane notion of antitrust, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a weird way in which it's mapping out, and then it becomes a question of, well, what do you really actually think? Like, who's, and it, again, in a way, it goes back to the conversation we were sort of having about policing, right? It actually is about whose sovereignty, whose liberty, whose freedom do you really, truly care about? Right? It's not as simple as, oh, I care about it or I don't, right? Right? It's actually whose. Whose are you kind of putting the thumb on the scale of, right? And it's like, oh, well, you know, the Jeff Bezos of the world, oh yeah, I really am concerned about their freedom. But, you know, not so much the Amazon workers or not so much the sweatshop workers or not, right? So that's, I'm done.
Okay. folks, This was a remarkable treatise on many things: the Northern Ireland riots, the troubles, corporations versus sovereign nations. Listeners, let me know: did any of what we said make sense? That's just number one. Are we all fired? Are we all fired from podcasting? Is my other question. We are done with today's show. I am so excited that you guys join. And what I would really love is for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all the wonderful stuff that you do. Sally, where do they do that?
I am on the interwebs, on the things that are not TikTok, because I don't need another thing. But the other things, I am at Sally Cohn, Kohn, and also at sallycohn.com. I know I can do this. This is where you can find me on the
And please follow her. She's so smart, as you can tell from this podcast. She's so fun and funny, and you should absolutely be following all of her wonderful works. Steven, where do they find you?
So you're going to go to twitter.com, sweetheart. Then there's a slash. Then you type in gossip babies. Okay, once again, that's gossip babies. Babies.
Gossip babies.
Babies, plural. And then if you want hot photos of me, you're going to go to Instagram, and it's going to be Buddha_PH. That one's a little trickier. That's more advanced, but I do believe that you can do it because you're a podcast listener. I'm talking to the listeners now.
Oh, I'm doing it right now. Okay. I was following the
directions. See?
This is, wait, we got like a live action example of someone being able to do it. Okay. And folks, I really, you know where to find me and all of the things that we shouldn't be listening, watching, or logging into ever. And also, I'm going to be on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this week, so be sure to log into that. And don't forget more new episode of Bird Girl on Sunday on the Cartoon Network through Adult Swim. And a big thank you to the people who make this show possible. That's our producer, Julia Linden, our sound engineer, Stephanie Aguilar, and all the wonderful people at HeadGum. The theme music is written by Gabby Alter. And as always, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts because it helps people find the show. And also email us at fakethenation@headgum.com so that you can send us guest ideas, segment ideas, anything you want, ideas. Also, join the Patreon. That's patreon.com/NakedFarsad. And that's it, folks. We'll be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.